Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. Welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how gerrymandering is leading to a disconnect between lawmakers and voters.
And why is summer air travel so bumpy?
But first, the U.S. Justice Department has sued the state over a newly enacted law, which the feds say runs afoul of the Constitution. HB 2492 requires voters to show proof of citizenship in order to vote for president, even if they use a federal form to register to vote. That form requires voters to swear under penalty of perjury that they are citizens and only allows signers to vote for president and Congress. The state form requires voters to show proof of citizenship to vote for all other offices. With us now to talk about the lawsuit and Arizona's history with this issue is Mary Jo Pitzel of the Arizona Republic. Hey, Mary Jo.
Good morning.
So what exactly is the Justice Department saying is the problem here with this new Arizona law?
Well, they say, first of all, it violates a Supreme Court ruling, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling from 2013 that allowed this sort of dual track of registration to happen. They say it also violates the Civil Rights Act, and it violates the National Voter Registration Act, which provided this way for federal-only voters to register.
Right. And so the way the system works now, right, is that if voters want to, are willing to show proof of citizenship, they sign up with the state form. They can vote for any election on the ballot. If they want to swear under penalty of perjury that they are citizens, they use the federal form, which only allows them to vote for president or Congress, right?
As I understand it, just for president, that the president and Senate, I think members of the House is a voter, is something that is still allowed with the state is still allowed to anybody who registers to vote.
Ah, okay.
Strange. Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of this new law that was passed through the legislature and the governor signed it this year, what was the rationale that lawmakers and the governor used to push this, saying that the state needs it?
Well, the main, you know, was the main argument was the one we heard with all the election related bills, which is that this will strengthen voter integrity. This will make our systems more reliable. But there was also an admission that maybe that U.S. Supreme Court ruling from 2013 that allowed the federal only registration form. Maybe that's not such a good idea. And let's see if we can get a case up before the court that would allow that to be reexamined.
Does it seem, and maybe this wasn't said out loud, but does it seem as though maybe there's a hope that with the current court, the state might get a more favorable outcome than it did in 2013?
I think you just said the quiet part out loud, Mark.
Got it. Well, I guess I said it, not the representatives. Was this part of the, like, we saw obviously a lot of election related laws this year. Was this part of the whole stop the steal idea that, like, people who weren't citizens were voting in Arizona and that somehow maybe caused Biden to win here?
Yes, that was part of the suspicion that drove this bill. This is one of the very, very few election-related bills that actually, you know, got through the legislature and got signed into law. And a lot of it was based on a concern that, you know, maybe, you know, why do we let people register to vote if, you know, they can't show proof of citizenship? Well, the answer is because we've got a federal court ruling and federal laws that allow that, that allow people to register as long as they attest under penalty of perjury that they are U.S. citizens. You know, that can be examined and, I guess, contested in court if someone wants to do that. And I'm not aware of any such challenges.
Now, the Justice Department lawsuit is not the only suit against this particular law, right?
Oh, no. In fact, the day after Governor Ducey signed this bill into law, two groups filed a suit in U.S. District Court. Living United for Change led a group of nonprofits in doing this. And the other one came from, I'm blanking on the other
Mi Familia Vota, I think, right?
Yeah, and Mi Familia Vota. So they were very quick to get this case into federal court. Both of those cases have been assigned to the same judge. And I suspect that this DOJ challenge will probably get assigned to the same judge and probably consolidated because they're all making, you know, effectively the same case.
I was going to ask if the arguments from these three challenges are roughly the same against this new law.
Yeah, yes, they are. You know, that they violate existing federal laws, that they that it would set up a state law that conflicts with federal law, which really makes it a mess for election administrators, because what are you supposed to do? Which law do you follow? You know, you're not going to win either way. So those are the heart of the argument. And, you know, the people most affected by this, it's believed to be tribal members who may not have this proof of residence, which a documentary proof of residence, which the bill requires, such something that shows where you live. Well, you know, a lot of Native Americans may not have a driver's license with a nice little street address, such as those of us that live in the urban areas have. They might have other documents that don't show their exact place. And the argument is that all of that is unnecessary because where you were born, whether it be in Poughkeepsie or in Paris, France, it doesn't really matter as long as you are a citizen. And it sort of ignores the fact that there are a lot of naturalized citizens who perhaps were born elsewhere, but are now eligible to vote in Arizona.
Right. Now, and we should also point out, just as we wrap this up, that this law does not take effect for the 2022 election, right? The state agreed to put this on hold temporarily.
Yeah, just so that it would not be confusing for this election cycle. And I was just seeking numbers on how many people are registered using the federal form. And the Secretary of State's office is updating that number right now, so we don't have a current one. But voter registration just closed yesterday, and they expect the number to go to go up a bit, because whenever you're very close to a voter registration deadline, you tend to get more people signing up to vote.
Right. All right. That is Mary Jo Pitzel of the Arizona Republic. Mary Jo, thanks as always for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
After more than 50 migrants were found dead inside a tractor trailer in San Antonio last week, U.S. Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin of Illinois said, quote, "I think what happened at the border with finding 51 dead migrants in that tractor trailer is what I would call a Uvalde moment. I hope it sparks an interest in finding a bipartisan approach to dealing with immigration," end quote. The Uvalde moment he was referring to was the mass shooting at an elementary school in that Texas town, which led to a bipartisan compromise on gun legislation. To find out if it'd be possible for senators to also agree on some kind of immigration and border security measure, I spoke late last week with Doris Meissner, senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute and director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program there, and I asked what she thought of Durbin's comments and if she thinks it's a realistic sentiment.
Well, I think it's certainly the right sentiment, and I've learned that he's in Europe right now with other members of Congress, and particularly Senator Tillis, who has been involved in immigration talks in the past and also was involved in the gun talks. So he and Senator Durbin seem to be talking about moving forward on immigration, and Uvalde is absolutely analogous in terms of its horror to what it needs to be done to change things, and that requires legislation and it requires Congress.
So given the way that we have seen Congress behave recently, we saw, as we've talked about, we've seen them pass very quickly a gun bill, which a lot of people had thought could never happen. Is it realistic that there could be some kind of bipartisan immigration bill?
Well, that's very hard to say, but it has to start somewhere, and this kind of an incident sometimes does serve the purpose of really focusing people's attention.
So in terms of actual policy proposals, where do you think would be a good place to start, both in terms of attracting bipartisan support, but also in terms of doing something that will actually make a difference?
Well, I do think that the point of agreement that's been the most widely understood and accepted, where they could start, does have to do with the DACA population in the United States. So that's a way to start to talk about immigration reform, giving them, this DACA population, a permanent status in the United States. But we know that the big issue, of course, is the border, and the big roadblock has always been, what do we do about border enforcement? So very quickly, this discussion will get to issues of the border. And what I hope can become clear and more clear out of this incident in San Antonio is that we cannot succeed as a country trying to enforce our way out of this issue of managing flows at the Southwest border. We've gone to the limits of what we can do with border enforcement, both in terms of just the actual operations, but also the vast amounts of money that have been poured into border enforcement. And the unfortunate part about this, or one unfortunate part about this politically, is that the call that we keep hearing is that until there's control at the border, we won't talk about anything else. And that is just backwards. It's the case that unless we do other things, unless we put other measures into place, we will not be able to enforce the border effectively.
So what kinds of specific policy ideas do you think Congress should be looking at then?
So the things that Congress needs to talk about, the things that really would make it possible to have a more rational enforcement picture at the border, do have to do with things that cannot be done at the border. First and foremost, or I don't even know if I would say that these are in order priority, but among the things that are critical are to have ways for migrants to come to the United States legally for work purposes. That can only be done by Congress. So legal pathways coming from the region is an important measure that the Congress could agree on. Another thing that is, of course, essential is a functioning asylum system. Many people that are coming to the border are claiming protection in the United States. They're coming from terrible conditions. Those conditions don't all qualify for asylum, but some proportion of them do. And we need to be able to make those decisions about who qualifies for asylum and who does not in a timely fashion, in a way that is fair, but in a way that does not take years and years of backlogs that both don't give people decisions who are in need of protection and should be getting on with their lives, but also invites people to try to come and apply for asylum on the hope that they can stay while they're in a backlog. Then I would say that where the border itself is concerned, of course it's important to continue to put proper resources into border enforcement and into border technology and so forth. But we have to recognize that the flows have changed. This is no longer the border of 5-10 years ago, where the vast majority of people crossing were Mexicans trying to work in the United States. We now have the largest share of people are coming, migrants from Central America and increasingly from other countries. And we have not really changed the border and our border infrastructure in ways that makes it possible to enforce the border with those different population groups. We need much more effort and investment and capacity at ports of entry. We need far more capacity, facilities, technology to be sure that the legal traffic is moving quickly, but the needle's in the haystack there, that our trafficking in drugs and in people can also be much more readily identified. Then I would say we also need a whole network of processing facilities along the Southwest border that really are multi-agency.
When you talk about the asylum process, I'm wondering what kind of impact you think the recent Supreme Court decision on the Migrant Protection Protocol, the quote-unquote Remain in Mexico program, will have, basically allowing the Biden administration to scrap it if it wants.
Yes, well, the Biden administration certainly will end that program as soon as it can. The Supreme Court decision upheld its authority to do so, and that means that people that had been returned to Mexico, people that had at least the beginnings of a possible claim for asylum, were being returned back to Mexico to wait there for their asylum claims to be decided. That would end. That would now mean that if you have an asylum claim, that on the first screening is valid, you would be able to pursue that asylum claim in the United States. And that is a smoother way to do things just from an efficiency standpoint, but it's clearly a far more humane way to do it because the circumstances of people waiting in Mexico for months and months and months really was an intolerable situation.
Doris Meissner is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute and director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program there.
It's Wednesday, and you're listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, as more and more people feel comfortable using air travel again, how are airlines handling an influx of customers?
People have wanted to travel since the pandemic began, and it was a matter of when they could really effectively do that.
Why the system, though, isn't always faring all that effectively right now.
But first, the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Dobbs case sent the issue of the legality of abortion to the states. An initial interpretation of this would indicate that so-called blue states would keep abortions legal and likely permissible further into a pregnancy, while so-called red states would place greater restrictions on the process and possibly make it completely illegal. But recent Republican efforts on redistricting and gerrymandering have made it so that some of the states considered to be more moderate or even left-leaning may be more restrictive on abortion because their legislatures may not actually be in line with what a majority of a state's residents believe. David Daley has studied and written about redistricting and gerrymandering extensively, and he's with me to explain what's going on and what could happen on issues like abortion and gun reform, for example. David, it seems very possible that gerrymandering could lead to more frequent legislative decisions not in line with what constituents want. Is that how you see it?
I think you're right, and I fear that that's what we're about to see nationwide. What Justice Alito wrote in his decision is that he wanted to return abortion rights to the people and to their elected representatives in state legislatures. But that line rings fairly hollow in a moment in which our democracy has, in many ways, never been less small d democratic in modern times. In state after state, even unexpected states where you might not imagine this to be the case, states like Oklahoma, states like Indiana and Georgia and Alabama, where lawmakers have already passed or are preparing really restrictive new abortion laws, those laws are not supported by anywhere close to a majority of the population. Indeed, they are opposed by a majority of voters, even in those red states.
You have written extensively in the past how this was a major part of the GOP or conservative playbook to control state legislatures. Was it because of power more generally or power more specifically when it comes to being able to control issues like abortion at the legislative level?
I think what we're looking at here is the result of a very long and determined plan by conservatives, by the political right, to effectively move the courts as well as state legislatures to the right in order to achieve policy outcomes that majorities of Americans actually don't want. When you cannot win those outcomes at the ballot box, when majorities actually oppose your policies on those issues, there's another way to go about winning. And that is to twist the rules of the system in such a way that you can't actually lose. You start with partisan gerrymandering. And in the 2010 election, at the beginning of the last redistricting cycle, Republicans were just coming off of a big defeat in the 2008 races, but they understood that the 2010 elections could be super consequential because it was a redistricting year. And so they set off on a strategy called REDMAP, the Redistricting Majority Project, to take control of swing state legislatures nationwide. So you're talking about Pennsylvania and North Carolina, Florida, Indiana, Georgia, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, states where Democrats and Republicans were in many places very evenly matched. Republicans took those state legislatures over and they redrew maps and have not lost a single chamber in those states in the last decade plus, even when Democratic candidates win hundreds of thousands of more votes. And then, of course, the other piece of this is really what's been a 50-year strategy by the Federalist Society and other Republican groups to push conservative loyalists onto the federal court, a real focus on state Supreme Courts as well. And I worry that the outcome of those two things is that it's pushing our politics into a dangerous direction of anti-majoritarian rule. In fact, we could be entering a long and sustained period of entrenched one-party minority rule.
We did see some gun reform legislation signed into law by President Biden recently. How important was the timing that this got done in the summer of 2022, considering what the House might look like in 2023 because of redistricting?
We are in this moment in which both houses of Congress could likely switch sides in fall 2022. And the 50 Democrats and the 50 Republicans in the U.S. Senate, it's really interesting. Those 50 Democrats actually represent 41.7 million more people than the 50 Republicans. We know of the advantages that Republicans have drawn themselves as far as redistricting nationwide and then in swing state legislatures. So this may well have been the last moment for some kind of compromise on these issues.
Are those issues felt by the majority enough that will overcome to some extent the redistricting that seems to make it clear that 2022 is going to be a good Republican year? Could there be some moderation in any way? Can it overcome redistricting in any way when voters see progress made on one issue and then perhaps the majority saying, I don't like what the Supreme Court did on this other issue?
Redistricting has proven almost impossible for Democrats to overwhelm, even when they have big majorities of votes. And this is the case in the U.S. House, and it's been the case in state legislatures. After the 2018 elections, for example, you had upwards of 50 million Americans who lived in a state in which one or both chambers of their state legislature, the branch of government that's supposed to be most directly responsive to the people, and yet one or more chambers was controlled by the party that won fewer votes in that fall's election. The U.S. Senate, again, you know, a deeply unrepresentative body, set up in order to be that way, but the structural changes and the population changes in the nation have really enhanced that. And then when you add the filibuster in, it really makes it almost impossible for Americans to get action on issues that they all agree on. Senator Angus King from Maine, in the middle of the voting rights debate over the winter, calculated that U.S. senators representing just 21% of the nation could use the filibuster to block progress or legislation that, you know, big majorities of Americans actually supported. So until we make the kind of structural change that allow for majority rule again, we are going to find that there's a real disconnect between the policies Americans want to see enacted and the legislation we actually get.
That is author David Daley. A couple of his books focused on redistricting and gerrymandering. One is Radeft, the other is Unrigged. David, thank you as always. Good to talk with you.
Always a pleasure, Steve. Thanks.
And now let's turn to the next conversation in our series, Out of Reach, where we're tackling the current housing crisis in our community. So far, we've heard from analysts, pollsters, and people whose lives have been upended by the skyrocketing prices and now rising interest rates. But now let's hear from someone who took a look at what's being done right.
Far fewer people of color own homes in the U.S. than white people. A lot goes into that, from the history of discriminatory housing policies like redlining, as well as current rates of mortgage denial and unequal access to financing today. But in a new analysis from Axios, race and justice reporter Russell Contreras found there are cities large and small in America where homeownership by people of color thrives, as he put it. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him more about it.
I want to begin with kind of the big picture numbers here. Like, homeownership rates among people of color are lower than among white people, much lower usually. What do the numbers look like nationally?
Well, right now, about 1 in 4 African Americans own their home, or a little less than 1 in 4, about 45%. For Hispanic Americans or Latinos, the homeownership rate is around 49%, and 59% for Asian Americans. But for white Americans, the homeownership rate is 74%. So as you can see, based on the latest numbers from 2022 in the first quarter, African Americans, Latinos, and Asian Americans, their homeownership rate is way lower than those of whites. Mm-hmm. This tells us that there's a significant wealth gap, but there's also a homeownership gap that's across the country nationally.
Let's talk a little bit about why. I mean, this goes back a long way. I know, you know, based on systemic housing discrimination, but it also still persists today. Can you draw that line for us between the history of things like redlining and what we see today?
That's a very good question. It's a combination of redlining, housing discrimination in the past, but also generational wealth that has been passed down. Look, African Americans, no matter how you want to frame it, are descendants from enslaved people. Latinos, especially those third, fourth, fifth generation Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans, are descendants of those who lived in the country when they faced just enormous amount of discrimination and repression. It takes generations to overcome that disparity, while whites have had money passed over, even if you're not that wealthy, over time. From basically buying a home in the 1950s and having that appreciate value, having access to something that Latinos and African Americans did not have. So, of course, over time, generational wealth will build up, and it's something that African Americans and Latinos are having to catch up with now.
Yeah. I want to talk about your analysis, though, of some places that seem to be doing this a little better, right? You're looking at places with the highest percentages of home ownership by people of color. First of all, you know, what stood out to you? What places?
Well, we looked at some census records and also some rankings by a website called constructioncoverage.com. And we found something very fascinating. We looked at some of the largest cities in the United States with a population over 350,000. And we saw that El Paso, Texas, has the highest homeownership rate among people of color at about 58.5%, followed by New Mexico. Not only that, these cities have high percentages of Latino homeownership. El Paso is 59%, nearly 60%. And this is, as we mentioned, nationally, it's, you know, at 49% for Latinos. So something's going on in these places. In Arizona, when we looked at the medium-sized cities, Gilbert, Arizona has the home ownership rate for Latinos is 54%. And for people of color, it is about 67% or almost 68%. So we have to ask ourselves, what's going on in Gilbert, Arizona? What's going on in Albuquerque, New Mexico? What's going on in Bakersfield? And yes, many of these cities are predominantly people of color. They're predominantly Latino. But that doesn't mean that the home ownership rates will be as high. Something's going on in these cities. And that when we talk to folks across the country where we see these high percentages, there are a number of things that they can point to. One is a diverse banking system with diverse mortgage lenders. There's a diversity of real estate agents. There's also financial literacy classes that have been embedded in either schools or in the persona of these places. So if I want to buy a home, I have access to these financial literacy classes and workshops that can tell me about credit when credit's due, how to build up one's credit and how to save up money, how much I should put down if I'm a first-time home buyer, etc. Mm-hmm. That's important so that it can demystify the process where if you don't come from a family that has had a home, if your parents rented all their life and your grandparents rented all your life, one could think that homeownership is not for you. And what these classes do and what this diversity of industry does is say, no, actually, you have access to that, and here's how to do it.
It seems like that is so basic in some ways. Like, were there systems, were there people in these places who did this on purpose, or was this sort of a natural, I guess, byproduct of being a more diverse place?
That's true. And I think we looked at the percentages and we looked at the towns that were ranked. When you look at some like Santan Valley, Arizona, or Peoria, Arizona, what's interesting is these places did not have the long history of systemic racism and redlining that other places have. Hmm. So when they popped out, when they grew as suburbs of Phoenix or suburbs of Tucson or whatever the case is, they started from scratch. Yes, they have barriers. Yes, they have systemic problems as everywhere else. But they didn't have that legacy of redlining, the legacy of Jim Crow or legacy of Juan Crow that other places. They could push that reset button faster mm-hmm. and get more results. Where if you try to do this in Chicago or Dallas, you're running up around generations of systemic racism. Let me give you an example. Atlanta, if I were to look at not just the redlining of the past, its maps, but look at the way school districts have been aligned, you can almost see the same segregation that you saw from 50, 60 years ago. And those districts have been redrawn to mimic the redlining of previous generations. Now, when you talk to folks, they say, we didn't do this on purpose. This is the way it's always been. That's something that's going on in a legacy city. But if you look at somewhere like Frisco, Texas, or Gilbert, Arizona, they didn't have that.
That's really interesting. I wonder how the housing market that we're in right now might play into this. Like, housing prices have gone up here in Phoenix, here in the Valley, here in Arizona, here across the country, just massively. You know, housing is hard to get for almost everybody right now. How does that play into this? Does that make it harder? Does that make these barriers even more difficult to overcome? Or does it kind of play the opposite way?
Well, in the cities that we looked at, what's interesting is there are suburbs of cities that are very expensive. Yeah. And these places have become affordable. Take, for example, Elk Grove, California. It's outside of Sacramento, the capital of the state. They have a home ownership rate of 72% for people of color. And for Latinos, it's 70%. So if you're getting marketed out of Sacramento and you can't even begin to afford out of the Bay Area and nearby San Francisco, you look at Elk Grove and say, well, I have some disposable income. I'm a middle class family, I have a good job, a teacher or a journalist, or I work in the industry sector, whatever the case is, Elk Grove and Frisco, Texas become viable options. So these cities have been able to grow because their nearby metropolitan areas have become almost unaffordable. You cannot attain a home there. For whatever reason, these places are affordable, they're accessible. And that's why we see the rates pretty high.
All right. Russell Contreras, race and justice reporter at Axios, author also of the Axios Latino newsletter, joining us. Russell, thank you for taking the time. Thank you for your reporting on this.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is The Show.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. The summer travel season has been a bit of a bumpy ride so far, especially for air travelers. Fares are up, as are the number of canceled and delayed flights. On Friday, at the start of the long holiday weekend, almost 2.5 million people passed through TSA checkpoints. But the flight tracker FlightAware reports more than a quarter of flights were delayed on that day. With me to talk about what's going on is Brett Snyder, president of Cranky Flyer and Cranky Concierge Travel Assistance. And Brett, there have been all sorts of disruptions so far this summer. Why is that?
Well, it's been quite the mess. And there are a lot of different things coming together to make it so difficult this summer. So on the one hand, you have just a really quick rebound of demand. You know, people have wanted to travel since the pandemic began, and it was a matter of when they could really effectively do that. And after the first Omicron wave things really just took off and people decided this summer is going to happen. I am traveling. And so, you know, that caused the airlines to try and ramp up as much as they possibly could. But the airlines had spent much of the pandemic convincing workers to take early retirement, early outs, whatever it might be, to try and save money. But that meant it was tougher for them to ramp back up. So they've tried. And then it's not just the airlines. So we've heard a lot of nightmare stories over in Europe, especially about security lines and issues with baggage handling and whatever else it might be. And then in the US, we have staffing issues with the FAA, with air traffic control. It's all just coming together to make it a difficult time.
Well, it sounds like a good amount of it anyway is related to what so many industries are dealing with, which is an issue of staffing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting because the airline industry was very unique during the pandemic in that it got a very large, you know, we'll call it a bailout. They hate when you call it that, but they got a very large amount of money to keep them flying. And it was the payroll support program. So they effectively had the government paying the wages of their people. But they looked at that. And as part of that, they weren't allowed to lay people off, but they were allowed to offer early retirements. And so they took a lot of that money and got people to leave. And then, of course, you just have the usual stress of people going through the pandemic, working these frontline jobs, having to interact with people, not necessarily feeling safe when this is going on. And then you roll into the Great Resignation, where you see this everywhere. And, you know, the airlines are not immune to that either. So absolutely, that some of this is not airline specific.
Right. Well, so what did we see over the July 4th weekend? I know that there were reports of airlines really trying to encourage travelers to rebook. What did you see? What was the industry looking at over the last several days?
It was pretty great because some of the airlines did such a good job of scaring the heck out of people that it did not go as badly as people probably thought it was going to. So we'll call that a win, I suppose. So, you know, if you look at the numbers, there were definitely some brighter spots. Some airlines did better than they had done earlier in the summer during much of June. But you still had significant issues. You know, the airline that really was out front warning everyone the most was Delta. Delta came out there and said, hey, we're not going to have a great weekend. And by the way, if you can change your travel plans, please do. We'll waive the fare difference. Just try not to fly this weekend. And so that set this expectation that Delta was going to be an absolute disaster this weekend. And instead, they were not an absolute disaster, but they were far from where they used to be, because Delta has for quite some time now had this reputation of being one of the best operational performers. And I went and pulled up the data looking at Anuvu data from the industry, and it shows from Friday through Monday, Delta had a good on-time performance. They had more than 80% of their flights arriving within 14 minutes of schedule, which is the standard for on-time performance that the Department of Transportation uses. But they still canceled more than 2% of their flights, which Delta rarely cancels anything. So 2% of your flights, that's still quite a bit. That was almost about 400 canceled flights over the weekend. So that was not good, but it was better than what I think they had gotten people to believe was going to happen.
Well, I guess that kind of raises the question of, like, is the airline industry in a situation right now where they're trying to lower expectations so that it doesn't seem as bad either to travelers or to analysts?
It's a good question. I think that you have different airlines doing different things. And so for Delta, which has long staked its reputation on being an operational outperformer, apparently Delta thought, hey, let's try and scare everyone into the fact that this is going to be miserable. And then if it is miserable, we can say we told them. But if it's not, then we can say, hey, it's a good news story. On the other hand, you have American, which obviously matters to a much greater extent in Phoenix, with their hub there. American had pretty similar performance to Delta, but American was quiet. So their strategy was to just not really talk about it, deal with it if the problems arose and figure it out. And then you have Southwest, obviously also another important piece in Phoenix. And Southwest had very few cancellations in the system. But they did take a hit on their on-time performance, because sometimes you can make that trade-off is, do we cancel fewer flights, but then we have to delay more? So Southwest has been doing some of that for this summer. They haven't been canceling nearly as many flights as some of the bigger guys, but you know, they have been delaying more flights. So it all just becomes a different game. It's for each airline to decide, how do we impact the fewest people?
So how long do you expect this to last? Like, I would imagine that the airlines are trying to ramp up their staffing so that they can not cancel flights and not have to warn travelers that particular weekends are going to kind of be a mess. Like, is this something that can be fixed in the short term?
That's right. For sure, they want to ramp that up. Now, what they've tried to do is, we have different airlines that have approached this differently for how they schedule. A lot of this is just about forecasting and understanding what you can actually operate as an airline. And there's so many moving parts, so many issues that can be outside of the airline's control, like employees getting COVID or staffing issues at the FAA that cause delays. All these things that are harder to model and predict. And so you have different airlines saying, where do we fall on this scale? Because we can cut more flights, but fares are already really high and we know people want to fly. So if we cut more flights, fares probably end up rising even more. But if we schedule more flights, then we may not be able to fly it. So it's this delicate, crazy balance. And when that ends, I don't know for sure, but certainly once you get past the summer, things start to ease because you do have less demand.
All right. That is Brett Snyder, president of Cranky Flyer. Brett, good to talk to you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to The Show.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Expectations for our own lives often lead to more questions than answers. Did I do the right thing? What do I do next? How am I feeling about my choices or where my life has ended up? That would seem to be more than enough to occupy our minds and energy. But because we don't just live by ourselves and our own heads, other individuals, or sometimes society at large, also creates expectations. For essayist Sari Botten, those expectations were related to having children and being a mom. She realized that wasn't what she wanted for herself, but wasn't able to feel firm in those convictions until she reached her 40s. Botten is the author of the new book, And You May Find Yourself, Confessions of a Late-Blooming Gen X Weirdo, and she's with me. Sari, there was a time a few decades ago when you were growing up that many women were expected by some parts of society to, quote, have it all and want it all. Did you think about what all meant to you in your 20s and how that's changed as you've gotten older?
Yeah, I think for me, it was almost more problematic that I was told I could have it all because I didn't really want it all. What I didn't want was children. And I didn't know I was allowed to just not want it. So I put myself through a lot of stress and expensive medical stuff to try and have children that I didn't want. And then I found out I couldn't have them. And it was an enormous relief. It took me until way too late to really invest in my creative career. It took me a long time to make sense of which things of the having it all package I actually wanted and which I didn't. I almost felt like I was compelled to try and have it all.
Was that compulsion nature or nurture?
We'll never know in terms of whether or not we want children. I wrestled with that, especially in my early 40s when the clock was ticking. And my second husband and I were going to a fertility clinic, and I felt like I was supposed to do this. I was supposed to want it. What was wrong with me that I didn't have this strong urge for it? The title of the book, which is taken from a Talking Heads song, Once in a Lifetime. The title is And You May Find Yourself, which is a refrain in the song. The first time I really heard those words in my head was when my second husband and I were sitting in a fertility clinic waiting room, and I was 42, and I thought, what am I doing here? Like, I had this almost complete out-of-body experience. And then a few minutes later, we were ushered into the doctor's office, and I had a completely other experience. The doctor did a heavy-duty sales pitch on us, and I thought, oh, maybe I am supposed to be here. And then we went in the back to a room where this woman puts you in touch with your insurance company and you find out whether or not you're covered, and we weren't. So I was being told this thing that you just found out 20 minutes ago you actually want, and you can't have it. And then that evening we drove to meet one of my husband's grandnephews, and that was in 2006, and this child was born on the same day that we were told we can't do this. And it was just this emotional roller coaster ride, and every moment of it was surreal. And I think a lot of women of every generation are told what they're supposed to want and what they're supposed to be able to do, and then they have to wrestle with discovering who they are despite that, or even within that. And for me, discovering that I wasn't who I was, quote unquote, supposed to be was really revelatory and also kind of freeing.
Yeah. So how much did finding yourself as an individual come from maturation process as an individual? How much of it was changing what your priorities were? Because I'm getting the impression that maybe your second husband was a little bit more in tune with you than your first. And did that support help, or were you just growing up at that point yourself and the man you were with didn't make as much of a difference?
That's an interesting question. You know, it's a chicken egg kind of thing. I think I found my second husband, who I'm still with, very happily married, only after I started to become really myself. And I talk in the book about going to see this really amazing therapist who helped me kind of cut through the nonsense and the noise to figure out who I really was and what I really wanted, which helped me find a partner who matched me better. We've been together 19 years. We've been married 17. We have a really good time together. And I wouldn't have been able to choose him before this therapist. But then I married Brian when I was almost 40, and I still had in my head this idea that I was supposed to want kids. And we went through like 2 years of dealing with this. But then when we both found out that I needed surgery and that I couldn't bear children, we were both so relieved. It was kind of hilarious. You know, we found out that I needed major surgery and we were both like, yeah, you know, like, we don't have to do this. And we both had this idea that it was something we were supposed to want. You know, that was supposed to be, if you're happy with each other, you're supposed to want to make more new people just like you. And we both didn't want to. I think we both really wanted to be what Jenny Ophill calls art monsters, and neither one of us felt entitled to it. So now we live in this house that we both kind of agree is like a little arts camp. We live in a 4-bedroom house where we each have a lot of little creative spaces. We have a recording studio in the attic that my husband is a recording engineer. We make music together. I have an office. He has an office. I mean, it's really fun. We have this very creative life that we love.
So it is amazing to write things and I imagine get feedback where people don't feel alone, or, you know, they can open themselves up, but they're not the only person feeling this. And here's this writer essayist who can really maybe put it in a way that many of us couldn't. But I also sort of feel like the need to ask you, and this has been more in the social media time over the past decade plus, is there such a thing as oversharing, or is that up to the writer herself to decide?
I think there is no subject that's off limits. Whether it's oversharing is determined by whether you've really processed the story before sharing it with the world. And so there's two levels to that processing. First, you need to live with the experience and make sense of it for yourself. You need to go through it. You need some critical distance from it. At The Moth, they say, write from your scars, not from your wounds. And that makes a lot of sense to me. So you want to have enough perspective on a difficult experience, or maybe not difficult, maybe just embarrassing. You want to have enough perspective on it that you can share it in a way that it has meaning. And that's the other, that's the next step of it, is that in the writing and then the revising and workshopping, your job as an essayist is to bring meaning to the piece or make meaning of it, so that it's not just sharing your journal. If you're just sharing your journal unprocessed, that can be oversharing. If you process it personally and then through the writing, through the revision, through workshopping, getting other people's perspective on it, you can bring it to a place where you are making meaning of your experience so that others can really relate to it, so that it really resonates. Even if someone's experience was similar but not exactly the same, or maybe it's a completely different set of circumstances but the emotions are the same, you really want to elevate your piece from an anecdote to an essay. And the way you do that is through processing and revision and workshopping.
The new book is And You May Find Yourself, Confessions of a Late-Blooming Gen X Weirdo. Sari Botten is the author. Thank you so much for the time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Steve, I think you're probably Gen X, definitely not a weirdo, though. So I would just point that out.
Thank you. Although she was not that happy with the title, if I remember right.
Really?
Yeah.
Come up with the title?
No, often publishers do. So she was apparently didn't have as much input. Okay. But hey, she embraced it eventually.
Right. That's what matters, right? Embrace yourself and your titles.
What gen are you, Mark?
I think I'm Gen X also.
I think so. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
That is Steve. I'm Mark. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great rest of your day. See you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Steve Goldstein. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, thanks for listening today.